Chapter 47 Genesis of Capitalist Ground Rent. Section 1 Introductory Remarks. We must clarify in our minds wherein, from the viewpoint of modern economics as the theoretical expression of the capitalist mode of production, lies the real difficulty in analysing ground rent. Even many of the more modern writers have not as yet grasped this, as evidenced by each renewed attempt to newly explain ground rent. The novelty almost invariably consists in a relapse into long out-of-date views. The difficulty is not to explain the surplus product produced by agricultural capital and its corresponding surplus value in general. This question is solved in the analysis of the surplus value produced by all productive capital, in whatever sphere it may be invested. The difficulty consists, rather, in showing the source of the excess of surplus value paid to the landlord by capital invested in land in the form of rent, after equalization of the surplus value to the average profit among the various capitals, after the various capitals have shared in the total surplus value produced by the social capital in all spheres of production in proportion to their relative size. In other words, the source subsequent to this equalization and the apparently already completed distribution of all surplus value, which, in general, is to be distributed. Quite apart from the practical motives which prodded modern economists, as spokesmen of industrial capital against landed property, to investigate this question, motives which we shall point out more clearly in the chapter on the history of ground rent, the question was of paramount interest to them as theorists. To admit that the appearance of rent for capital invested in agriculture is due to some particular effect produced by the sphere of investment itself, due to singular qualities of the earth's crust itself, is tantamount to giving up the conception of value as such, thus tantamount to abandoning all attempts at a scientific understanding of this field. Even the simple observation that rent is paid out of the price of agricultural produce, which takes place even where rent is paid in kind, if the farmer is to recover his price of production, showed the absurdity of attempting to explain the excess of this price over the ordinary price of production. In other words, to explain the relative dearness of agricultural products on the basis of the excess of natural productivity of agricultural production over the productivity of other lines of production. For the reverse is true. The more productive labour is, the cheaper is every aliquot part of its product, because so much greater is the mass of use values incorporating the same quantity of labour, that is, the same value. The whole difficulty in analysing rent, therefore, consists in explaining the excess of agricultural profit over the average profit. Not the surplus value, but the excess of surplus value characteristic of this sphere of production. In other words, not the net product, but the excess of this net product over the net product of other branches of industry. The average profit itself is a product formed under very definite historical production relations by the movement of social processes, a product which, as we have seen, requires very complex adjustment. To be able to speak at all of a surplus over the average profit, this average profit itself must already be established as a standard and as a regulator of production in general, as is the case under capitalist production. For this reason, there can be no talk of rent in the modern sense, a rent consisting of a surplus over the average profit, that is, over and above the proportional share of each individual capital in the surplus value produced by the total social capital, in social formations where it is not capital, which performs the function of enforcing all surplus labour and appropriating directly all surplus value. And where, therefore, capital has not yet completely, or only sporadically, brought social labour under its control. It reflects naivety, for example, of a person like Passy, when he speaks of rent in primitive society as a surplus over profit, a historically defined social form of surplus value, but which, according to him, might almost as well exist without any society. Passy, Rente du Sol, in Dictionnaire de l'Économie Politique, Volume 2, Paris, 1854. For the older economists, who in general merely begin analysing the capitalist mode of production, still undeveloped in their day, the analysis of rent offers either no difficulty at all, or only a difficulty of a completely different kind. Petty, Cantillon, and in general those writers who are closer to feudal times, assume ground rent to be the normal form of surplus value in general. Petty, A Treatise on Taxes and Contributions, London, 1667. Richard Cantillon, Essai sur la Nature du Commerce en Général, Amsterdam, 1756. Whereas profit to them is still amorphously combined with wages, or at best appears to be a portion of surplus value extorted by the capitalist from the landlord. These writers thus take as their point of departure a situation where, in the first place, the agricultural population still constitutes the overwhelming majority of the nation, and secondly, the landlord still appears as the person appropriating at first hand the surplus labour of the direct producers, by virtue of his monopoly of landed property, where landed property, therefore, still appears as the main condition of production. For these writers, the question could not yet be posed, which, inversely, seeks to investigate from the viewpoint of capitalist production how landed property manages to wrest back again from capital a portion of the surplus value produced by it, that is, filched by it from the direct producers, and already appropriated directly. The physiocrats are troubled by difficulties of another nature. As the actually first systematic spokesmen of capital, they attempt to analyse the nature of surplus value in general. For them, this analysis coincides with the analysis of rent, the only form of surplus value which they recognise. Therefore, they consider rent-yielding, or agricultural capital, to be the only capital producing surplus value, and the agricultural labour set in motion by it the only labour producing surplus value, which, from a capitalist viewpoint, is quite properly considered the only productive labour. They are quite right in considering the creation of surplus value as decisive. Apart from other merits to be set forth in Volume 4, they deserve credit primarily for going back from merchants' capital, which functions solely in the sphere of circulation, to productive capital, in opposition to the mercantile system, which, with its crude realism, constitutes the actual vulgar economy of that period, pushing into the background, in favour of its own practical interests, the beginnings of scientific analysis made by Petty and his successors. In this critique of the mercantile system, incidentally, only its conceptions of capital and surplus value are dealt with. It has already been indicated previously that the monetary system correctly proclaims production for the world market and the transformation of the output into commodities and thus into money as the prerequisite and condition of capitalist production. In this system's further development into the mercantile system, it is no longer the transformation of commodity value into money, but the creation of surplus value, which is decisive. But from the meaningless viewpoint of the circulation sphere, and, at the same time, in such manner that this surplus value is represented as surplus money, as the balance of trade surplus. At the same time, however, the characteristic feature of the interested merchants and manufacturers of that period, which is in keeping with the stage of capitalist development represented by them, is that the transformation of feudal agricultural societies into industrial ones, and the corresponding industrial struggle of nations on the world market, depends on an accelerated development of capital, which is not to be arrived at along the so-called natural path, but rather by means of coercive measures. It makes a tremendous difference whether national capital is gradually and slowly transformed into industrial capital, or whether this development is accelerated by means of a tax which they impose through protective duties mainly upon landowners, middle and small peasants, and handicraftsmen, by way of accelerated expropriation of the independent direct producers, and through the violently accelerated accumulation and concentration of capital. In short, by means of the accelerated establishment of conditions of capitalist production. It simultaneously makes an enormous difference in the capitalist and industrial exploitation of the natural, national, productive power. Hence, the national character of the mercantile system is not merely a phrase on the lips of its spokesmen. Under the pretext of concern solely for the wealth of the nation and the resources of the state, they, in fact, pronounce the interests of the capitalist class and the amassing of riches in general to be the ultimate aim of the state, and thus proclaim bourgeois society in place of the old divine state. But at the same time, they are consciously aware that the development of the interests of capital and of the capitalist class, of capitalist production, forms the foundation of national power and national ascendancy in modern society. The physiocrats, furthermore, are correct in stating that, in fact, all production of surplus value, and thus all development of capital, has for its natural basis the productiveness of agricultural labour. If man were not capable of producing in one working day more means of subsistence, which signifies in the strictest sense more agricultural products than every labourer needs for his own reproduction, if the daily expenditure of his entire labour power sufficed merely to produce the means of subsistence indispensable for his own individual requirements, then one could not speak at all either of surplus product or surplus value. An agricultural labour productivity exceeding the individual requirements of the labourer is the basis of all societies, and is above all the basis of capitalist production, which disengages a constantly increasing portion of society from the production of basic foodstuffs and transforms them into free heads. As Stewart, An Inquiry into the Principles of Political Economy, Volume 1, Dublin, 1770, has it, making them available for exploitation in other spheres. But what can be said of more recent writers on economics, such as Dare, Passy, etc., who parrot the most primitive conceptions concerning the natural conditions of surplus labour and thereby surplus value in general, in the twilight of classical economy, indeed on its very deathbed, and who imagine that they are thus propounding something new and striking on ground rent. Dare, Introduction in Physiocrats, Part 1, Paris 1846, and Passy, Rente du Sol, in Dictionnaire de l'Économie Politique, Volume 2, Paris, 1854, long after this ground rent has been investigated as a special form and become a specific portion of surplus value. It is particularly characteristic of vulgar economy that it echoes what was new, original, profound, and justified during a specific outgrown stage of development in a period when it has turned platitudinous, stale, and false. It thus confesses its complete ignorance of the problems which concerned classical economy. It confounds them with questions that could only have been posed on a lower level of development of bourgeois society. The same holds true of its incessant and self-complacent rumination of the physiocratic phrases concerning free trade. These phrases have long since lost all theoretical interest, no matter how much they may engage the practical attention of this or that state. In natural economy proper, when no part of the agricultural product, or but a very insignificant portion, enters into the process of circulation, and then only a relatively small portion of that part of the product which represents the landlord's revenue, as, for example, in many Roman latifundia, or the villas of Charlemagne, or more or less during the entire Middle Ages, see Vinçart, Histoire du Travail. The product and surplus product of the large estates consists by no means purely of products of agricultural labour. It encompasses equally well the products of industrial labour. Domestic handicrafts and manufacturing labour as secondary occupations of agriculture, which forms the basis, are the prerequisite of that mode of production upon which natural economy rests. In European antiquity and the Middle Ages, as well as in the present-day Indian community, in which the traditional organization has not yet been destroyed. The capitalist mode of production completely abolishes this relationship, a process which may be studied on a large scale, particularly in England, during the last third of the 18th century. Thinkers like Ehrenschwand, who had grown up in more or less semi-feudal societies, still consider, for example, as late as the close of the 18th century, this separation of manufacture from agriculture as a foolhardy social adventure, as an unthinkably risky mode of existence. And even in the agricultural economies of antiquity, showing the greatest analogy to capitalist agriculture, namely Carthage and Rome, the similarity to a plantation economy is greater than to a form corresponding to the really capitalist mode of exploitation. Footnote. Adam Smith emphasizes how, in his time, and this applies also to the plantations in tropical and subtropical countries in our own day, rent and profit were not yet divorced from one another. Smith, An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations, Aberdeen, London, 1848. For the landlord was simultaneously a capitalist, just as Cato, for instance, was on his estates. But this separation is precisely the prerequisite for the capitalist mode of production, to whose conception the basis of slavery, moreover, stands in direct contradiction. End of footnote. A formal analogy, which simultaneously, however, turns out to be completely illusory in all essential points to a person familiar with the capitalist mode of production who does not, like Herr Mommsen, discover a capitalist mode of production in every monetary economy, is not to be found at all in continental Italy during antiquity, but at best only in Sicily, since this island served Rome as an agricultural tributary, so that its agriculture was aimed chiefly at export. Farmers, in the modern sense, existed there. Footnote. Herr Mommsen, in his Roman History, by no means uses the term capitalist in the sense employed by modern economics and modern society, but rather in the manner of popular conception, such as still continues to thrive, though not in England or America, but nevertheless on the European continent, as an ancient tradition reflecting bygone conditions. End of footnote. An erroneous conception of the nature of rent is based upon the fact that rent in kind, partly as tithes to the church, and partly as a curiosity perpetuated by long-established contracts, has been dragged over into modern times from the natural economy of the Middle Ages, completely in contradiction to the conditions of the capitalist mode of production. It thereby creates the impression that rent does not arise from the price of the agricultural product, but from its mass, thus not from social conditions, but from the earth. We have previously shown that although surplus value is manifested in a surplus product, the converse does not hold, that a surplus product, representing a mere increase in the mass of product, constitutes surplus value. It may represent a minus quantity in value. Otherwise, the cotton industry of 1860, compared with that of 1840, would show an enormous surplus value, whereas on the contrary, the price of the yarn has fallen. Rent may increase enormously as a result of a succession of crop failures, because the price of grain rises, although this surplus value appears as an absolutely decreasing mass of dearer wheat. Conversely, the rent may fall in consequence of a succession of bountiful years, because the price falls, although the reduced rent appears as a greater mass of cheaper wheat. As regards rent in kind, it should be noted now that in the first place it is a mere tradition carried over from an obsolete mode of production and managing to prolong its existence as a survival. Its contradiction to the capitalist mode of production is shown by its disappearance of itself from private contracts, and its being forcibly shaken off as an anachronism, wherever legislation was able to intervene, as in the case of church tithes in England. Secondly, however, where rent in kind persisted on the basis of capitalist production, it was no more, and could be no more, than an expression of money rent in medieval garb. Wheat, for instance, is quoted at 40 shillings per quarter. One portion of this wheat must replace the wages contained therein, and must be sold to become available for renewed expenditure. Another portion must be sold to pay its proportionate share of taxes. Seed, and even a portion of fertilizer, enter as commodities into the process of reproduction. Wherever the capitalist mode of production, and with it division of social labour, are developed. That is, they must be purchased for replacement purposes. And therefore, another portion of this quarter must be sold to obtain money for this. Insofar as they need not be bought as actual commodities, but are taken out of the product itself in kind, in order to enter into its reproduction anew as conditions of production, as occurs not only in agriculture, but in many other lines of production producing constant capital, they figure in the books as money of account, and are deducted as elements of the cost price. The wear and tear of machinery and of fixed capital in general must be made good in money. And finally comes profit, which is calculated on this sum, expressed as costs either in actual money or in money of account. This profit is represented by a definite portion of the gross product, which is determined by its price. And the excess portion, which then remains, forms rent. If the rent in kind stipulated by contract is greater than this remainder determined by the price, then it does not constitute rent, but a deduction from profit. Owing to this possibility alone, rent in kind is an obsolete form, insofar as it does not reflect the price of the product, but may be greater or smaller than the real rent, and thus may comprise not only a deduction from profit, but also from those elements required for capital replacement. In fact, this rent in kind, so far as it is rent not merely in name but also in essence, is exclusively determined by the excess of the price of the product over its price of production. Only it presupposes that this variable is a constant magnitude. But it is such a comforting reflection that the product in kind should suffice, first, to maintain the labourer, secondly, to leave the capitalist tenant farmer more food than he needs, and finally, that the remainder should constitute the natural rent. Quite like a manufacturer producing 200,000 yards of cotton goods. These yards of goods not only suffice to clothe his labourers, to clothe his wife, all his offspring, and himself abundantly, but also leave over enough cotton for sale, in addition to paying an enormous rent in terms of cotton goods. It is all so simple. Deduct the price of production from 200,000 yards of cotton goods, and a surplus of cotton goods must remain for rent. But it is indeed a naive conception to deduct the price of production of, say, £10,000 from 200,000 yards of cotton goods without knowing the selling price, to deduct money from cotton goods, to deduct an exchange value from a use value as such, and thus to determine the surplus of yards of cotton goods over pounds sterling. It is worse than squaring the circle, which is at least based upon the conception that there is a limit at which straight lines and curves imperceptibly flow together. But such is the prescription of Monsieur Passy. Deduct money from cotton goods before the cotton goods have been converted into money either in one's mind or in reality. What remains is the rent, which, however, is to be grasped naturally. See, for example, die Naturgemäße Volkswirtschaft gegenüber dem Monopoliengeister und dem Kommunismus, Hanau, 1845, and not by devilries of sophistry. The entire restoration of rent in kind is finally reduced to this foolishness: the deduction of the price of production from so many and so many bushels of wheat, and the subtraction of a sum of money from a cubic measure.